Welcome back to episode 104 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we don't just seek to highlight the glories of ratings gain, but we dive into the plateaus and the pits of despair below that. If you count losing 150 rating points in like 3 months, then I'm in a pit of despair. I want to thank our Patreon supporters, Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Donna Rich Burgess, Brandon Halsey, David Shriver, Lindsay Newhall, Jeff Peterson, Tobias Rex, Bob's Burgers, and the King level supporter, Ian Samples. If you want to support the show, that's a great place to do it. I have been streaming a lot on Dr. Skull_Tiny Grimes, putting some videos on YouTube. Yesterday, I was looking at some Capablanca games, trying to eradicate a problem in my game, which goes like this. I'm winning. Ooh, I got a cool move. Does it work? Maybe it works and it doesn't work, and then I lose. It's horrible. If you want to appear on the show, you can fill out the Google form in the show notes. If you're interested in Noel Studer's next level training program, you can use the code in the show notes below. That will support the show. I really appreciate it. And today, I bring on a very special guest. He is a grandmaster. He is a man that really needs no introduction, but I'm going to go ahead and put a little introduction in anyways, just in case you don't know the one and only Jacob Agard. Whatever you call him is probably the wrong pronunciation. I'm just going to tell you that now. But in case you don't know him, he's a publisher, he's an author, he's a coach, he runs Killer Chess Training, and he's a grandmaster, so he's pretty good at chess and has a lot of good ideas for us. Jakob, welcome to the show, and have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
Thank you very much. No, not play. That's probably wrong. I think I did play a game or two on Lee Chess with my phone sitting for Pastor to board. I have to give you a little correction here. I don't run Killer Chess Training. I'm one of the owners, but Kalia Klesahaki is the boss. I'm very much involved in it. I'm one of the three owners and have a big say on the educational program and stuff like that. But it's not my business in the way that I run it.
Gotcha. Okay.
One of the owners, but yeah, no, it's definitely a good place to find me. And if you know, in the video, I don't know if people will see this as a video or on audio only, but on the video you can see I have my Killer Chess Training background behind me.
Yeah, it looks cool. Can you give us a quick clarification also on how to pronounce your name, just so our listeners can hear once and for all the correct pronunciation?
Yeah, it's Jakob Ogol.
Okay. All right. So all of you out there, you're probably saying it wrong. Let's all together try to get it right.
Yeah. All no, right. But I don't care. No, I don't take myself seriously. And I just don't think I'm important enough to take seriously, you know. And I think I get my point much better across on things I want to talk about if I'm not taken too seriously. So.
Okay, that's interesting, because when I think of you, I think of you as one of the most important chess figures. I mean, like as someone who is just trying to get better at chess, I consider you personally to be more important than most of the elite chess players, because you have a larger impact on me, because I can buy all of your books. They can sit on a shelf and I cannot open them because I'm not good enough to read them yet. But don't worry, one day I will be good enough to read them, I hope.
You need bigger shelves than what you have in the background if you want all the books in one shelf. Just to clarify here, but
that's true. I only have like six of them, so I don't have anywhere close to all of them.
No. You and I don't have them all.
All right. I thought we could, before we get into what I imagine is going to be the best part of the show for the improvers out there, which is to hear all of your words of wisdom. I don't really know that much about your actual chess career other than what I've read in things like Thinking Inside the Box. Can you give us a quick update? Like, when did you get into chess? Were you like a four-year-old and you were just a natural prodigy and your parents were like, oh my goodness, he's going to be the world champion? Like, what did your own trajectory look like?
Well, very, very much the opposite. So my parents taught me the game at six. I started crying when I lost. And they said, oh, you're not allowed to play then.
Oh!
Then I some friend in school taught me again around 10 or reintroduced me. Huh. And I got into it. I started in a club around 12. And you could say I'm talented on a village level. You know, the village had 15,000 people. And I was the second most talented player there. I crossed 1900 at 16. Hmm. And then later on, I was sort of stuck between 22 and 2300 for a long time. I improved a little bit around age 22, 23. At 23, I became IM and definitely played much better. But then over the next 6-7 years, I slowly declined. I was down to, I think I was 23.53. People can check this on the FIDE website if they care enough. I was 23.53 and I played a tournament in Budapest, I think 2002. And it was like one of these cases just after, a bad breakup and these kind of things. And my mind was just not there. And I blundered the entire chess set. Like, you show me a piece, I blundered it in this tournament.
Oh, no.
And I won rating. And I realized, okay, I really hit bottom last time. You know, I blundered almost every game. And like, I blundered the queen in a winning position. Like, just it was so bad. But then, I don't know, it sort of clicked at me at some point. I started working differently. And what I was doing is not how I recommend other people to work. So I'm not going to go too much into that. But then I improved a lot from 2002 to 2004.
Hmm.
And in 2004, I played 5 tournaments. And it was like GM norm. And then 5 draws, 4 losses, or 6 draws, 3 losses or something. But, you know, like the draws were Magnus Carlsen, Peter Heine Nielsen.
Yeah.
I lost to Beliarski, Rosenthalis, and some close GM tournament. And then GM norm. Wow. And then I played some other tournament. That was my 2004. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to become a grandmaster soon.
Yeah.
And then I played in... Capelle, it's called Capelle Le Grand, in France in the beginning of 2005. And I had one horrible draw with a French kid. And then I lost to another French kid, and they were both like rated 21, 2200.
Mm.
And I lost a lot of rating. And I thought, okay, that's a long way to 2500. And I sort of blacked out a year. And these juniors, I drew with Romain Edouard, who later was 2700.
Yeah,
and is a famous chess author, and then I lost to Sebastian Feller, who later on was evicted from the game more or less because of cheating at the 2010 Olympiad. So I got sort of my head back into it at some point. Played better in 2006 and 7, won the British Championship in 2007. And I have to check, either on my 34th birthday or the day after I became a GM during the tournament. And it was like the day I thought I became a GM, I didn't actually become a GM. It was the next game, which was like a totally, totally wild game where at some point I sacrificed my queen incorrectly.
Oh,
and
wow.
My opponent could have won in one move. And so many things. So anyway, I horrible game, horrible tournament in many ways, but very up and down chess, and I won it. And then later that year, my first child was born, and actually more importantly for my chess playing career, we were 3 people in quality chess from the beginning, but we downsized to 2. And I had to take over being the day-to-day manager, which luckily I'm not anymore. And in 2008, when I asked for a condition for the British Championship to come and defend my title, I was I was not treated well by the English Chess Federation. And it was clear for a long time that they were tired. First, they had the English Championship and the Commonwealth was combined. And they got tired of Indians becoming winning and becoming British champions. And then they eliminated the Commonwealth part of it. It became a separate event. It's now almost always held in India. It's just another Indian championship with a few other players. They do it very well, so no criticism of them. Anyone who wants to go and play are welcome, you know. Yeah. But eventually, after months of asking, they offered me student accommodation with a shower in the hallway as defending champion. And I just thought, okay, well, I'm not going to make anything more than out of my chess career than British champion. Mm-hmm. And student accommodation and the shower in the hallway. And you have to harass them for it. I just thought, no. And so I actually went and played in Denmark at the same time, and I played very well, beat 2 2600s in a row. And wow. I could have possibly defended the title. You never know what would have happened. But but after that, I sort of, as a chess player, I won the Scottish Championship 2012. And, you know, there's been individual good results and so on. But really, I had this thing, which is probably the two other things that has to be explained here. The one is that I tend to care more about my students' results than my own. And this predates the time when my students' results were better than my own. So, you know, like I would play a top group and I would waste my time by going around looking at the kids I was coaching playing in the lower groups to see how they were doing and getting too involved in their games. And I think that's the way some people are, and some people are not like that. And for me, it's great to have someone like, let's say, Sam Shanklin, who I've worked with for a decade, who is absolutely able to, you know, care and do work with others. And like nothing about his personality is under criticism from me. But he is mainly focused on his own play.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, as a natural-born trainer, it would be horrible if such a person didn't exist. You know, if nobody cared, like, I want to care about your play. Yeah, but I don't care. Like, that wouldn't work. The other thing with me being talented, no. Like, as I said, I have the number two talent of a village. And that's maybe more than average. But like, let's say, out of the kids who played chess in that village chess club, I overtook the other guy, and the rest of them don't play. So, you know, it's not as if the others are so important in that sense. But my lack of talent has been a tremendous asset for me as a coach and as a writer, because everything I talk about is something I had to fight for. Nothing really came to me easily and for free. I had to fight for every level. And it makes it possible for me to understand how you coach someone. And the bizarre thing to some extent is that the stuff I'm teaching 2,000-rated players is also the stuff I'm teaching to my 2750 student, you know? So
you just make it more challenging for the 2700s, or do you just feel like there are...
Well, often it's it just goes faster, you know? But the mistakes that top players make are often quite basic. So if we can imagine there's... 1,000 things you should know, or 5,000 things, you know, no matter how good you are, you're going to have some holes.
Yeah.
Now, there's this Norwegian kid, well, he's not a kid anymore, who doesn't seem to have many holes. But for everyone else, you know, you have very glaring holes in their play. And, you know, if you have a good methodology as a coach and experience and understanding of the game, you can absolutely help anyone. Some things, maybe they don't need help other than keeping things going. So calculation, for example, one of my students is fantastic at calculation. He just needs to have routinely use it so he doesn't lose it. Yeah. While for others, you know, like quite a lot of top players, I would say, okay, let's start with the basics. But the advantage of having no talent is immense as a coach.
It's really interesting. I've heard that a lot about teachers. Like the best teachers are teachers that sort of struggled in school because so they can have a better understanding of what it's like to help a struggling student. So I've heard that quite a bit. I'm curious. You said something that piqued me. I want to follow up on this. You said just threw out a number. There's 5,000 things every, you know, that you need to know. This sounds like an amazing book. It's just a checklist. The 5,000 things you need to know in chess. And it's just a checklist. And you go down one by one. You're like, oh man, I only know 70 of these. This is why I'm so bad at chess. Do you think about it that way at all? Or is that just kind of like an
No, I don't really, because a lot of the things is combinations of different things. If we take last year I published a small in-game book here, which it's bigger than it looks on the inside, sort of like the Doctor Who of chess books. It actually, I compared it with books from other publishers. I'm holding up A Matter of Endgame Technique. I compared it with books from other chess publishers, and for this size, you only get 700 pages from them. But this one here is 898 pages, two of them blank, so I normally say 896. But chapter one of this book, which is a mere 300 pages, covers the, I think it's 73 basic endgame ideas.
Ah, okay.
Now, is this necessarily all the basic endgame ideas? No, but are there many combinations of them? Yes. And they're not theory. So, for example, there's this famous book, 100 Endgame Positions You Must Know.
Yeah.
Does it mean there's not a 101st position? Oh, there is.
Yeah.
I think for endgame theory, the correct number of position you should know is maybe around 500, 500, 600. Dretzky had 220, I think, in the Dretzky Endgame Manual. A lot of them are ideas, not so much positions, fixed positions. But there's also a lot of stuff I feel missing in that book.
So you rook feel against like
three pawns. There's some very basic theory positions that are not there. And the other kind of positions.
550. The real book is 550 endgames you must know.
Something like that. But
okay.
I don't think it has the same marketing value. It's like the 10,000 steps and learn a new habit in 4 weeks and so on. It's all thought up by the marketing department and not, you know, you could easily see De Avia, who I cannot say anything bad about him or his books. The books are great. The man is great. But you could easily see him sitting there with 101 positions thinking like, I really don't want to shock anyone. Or with 99 and thinking like, I have to include another one. You know, I have these three questions that I use a lot as a training method, which are where the weakness is, what's the worst place piece, and what's the opponent's idea? Because it's everything, right? It's the pawns and the structure, it's the pieces, and it's the opponent. That's chess. That's everything.
Yeah.
There was this funny attempt to copy it, like having three other questions, which was Kramnik did some simple thing for Chessable, and they clearly wanted to, you know, three questions sounds great. Let's do our own version. And I think two of the questions were like identical content, like of the three questions. So they didn't even make it to three. But like obviously that's fair game to do. They can do whatever they want and so on. But it felt like forced and not come mm-hmm. out of a need for three.
That's funny. So
anyway.
Quick final questions on your own journey. I'm curious, you said you hit, what was it, like 1900 at 16? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Something like that. So at that time, did you feel like you were like on a trajectory to be a grandmaster, or did you feel like you were sort of behind the curve? It's kind of hard to, like, I feel like today, if you were 1900 at 16, you wouldn't be on like the elite chess player trajectory. But back then, did it feel more like you were on that trajectory?
No. You know, this is, so it's 16 and that's 1989.
Which
dates me a bit. I'll be 50 the week after next.
Oh,
wow.
We both turn 50 this year.
Yeah, well, I might turn first. Yeah.
Yep. You'll beat me.
Yeah. I'm same birthday as J.K. Rowling
and
Nigel Davis. All the famous guys. Grandmaster at that point in Denmark, we only had Kurt Hansen, who, you know, had been junior world and European champion, and was at that point, he had, in 1988, he had messed up a winning position against Kasparov at the Olympiad. He was at his peak, he was number nine, I think. And Bent Larsen, who at his peak was top three. Yeah. So it's like, that was the grandmasters.
Okay.
And, I actually won the Danish Junior Championship 2020 because the three players that were stronger than me in my age group didn't play.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the reason why they didn't play was that year, because it was a qualifier for European Junior. That year, the European Junior was going to be in Denmark and they were all three invited. As you know, special rights of the organizer. So that was maybe one of them. Peter Heine wouldn't have played, but the two others usually were fighting far in front of me in the pack. So no, it was only when I got into my 20s and became an IM that I thought I was going to get better, but I didn't think I would become a grandmaster until around the time when I started making norms.
Yeah, and you said that was in your 30s?
Yeah, my first norm was in 2004. So it was like 5th of January 2004.
So it sounds to me like there's a pretty good big gap there between when you hit IM, when you hit GM. Was there any doubt in there where you were like, all right, I got to give this thing up, this is not working? Or were you already embedded in the chess world as a coach, as a trainer, and you were just kind of still playing, kind of hoping that this was going to happen? Like, what's the mindset there?
Well, I was doing quite well in academia. I went to university in for the second time in 98, I think. And then I did like 1 year, 98, 99. And then 99 to 2000, I thought this was ridiculously easy. So I did year two and three in one go.
Oh, wow.
And then I never finished year four. I sort of got the... Basically what happened was... I met Murray Chandler somewhere and he convinced me to write a book. So I wrote Easy Guide to the Panopet Winning Attack. And then I also wrote Easy Guide to the Sveshnikov. And then I met Byron Jacobs through a mutual friend. We were just out for dinner. I followed the mutual friend for dinner and Byron was there and Joe Gallagher was there and they agreed a book on the Tromposki, I think it was, right there. And Byron just wrote him a check for half the advance, or like the advance before, and the other half on delivery. And we sort of talked about it, and I I had this some ideas in this Schliemann variation, which is really horrible. E4, E5, Knight F3, Knight C6, Bishop B5, F5, EF5, Knight D4. I had some early success before computers with this nonsense. The idea is sort of that a lot of things goes wrong, but you get this great structure in the center. Wow. It's like King's Gambit three tempos down, just to sell it.
Sounds
but
amazing.
Anyway, so I suggested that, but he asked me, and he said, nah. And he's like, we really want a book on the Stonewall. I was like, Stonewall? I've never played the Stonewall. So we sort of got... He really wanted a book on the Stonewall, as I remember it. Maybe he can correct it. And I said, okay, I'll write you a book on the Stonewall. But then I want to write a book that I want to write also. Sure. Mm-hmm. Fine. And that became Excelling at Chess, where, you know, I wrote it basically for a few friends. I thought nobody would buy it. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, on the one page, I'm a little critical of Kasparov, and the other next page, I'm very, very friendly towards my friends. You know, you really have to understand, you know, I thought nobody would care, right? And that was then a success, maybe for that reason. And they asked me for more books and more books. And I thought, yeah, sure, this is easy. And I just did the books. And then I had friends who were like, oh, you're writing these books now. Could you help me? You know, I can't speak English really well, but I have this material. And okay, so we co-wrote. And in that period, the books by Alexander Rejewski and Maxim Chetverek for Everyman, that was me. And for Jan Pinsky for Everyman, that was also me.
Oh,
and Indri Vej, there was a starting out in the Benoni, modern Benoni, something like that, which was, I think, mainly me. This material Indri sent was, it didn't work very well. So this is
during when you should be doing your fourth year of school, is when you pick this up. So was writing these books so lucrative that you were like, I don't need
it? No, it was just easy.
Okay.
It was easier. It was fun.
Okay.
So and that was that's fun thing to do. Maybe part of the reason why the books are not better than they were, you know?
Interesting.
But it was easy. It was fun. I was playing. And
okay.
I was traveling and, you know, like living the student life, getting into debt, you know, and...
Yeah, it sounds great.
You know, I couldn't take university seriously. I thought it was the topic was also bad. I think I was studying literature. I like literature. I don't like academic literature at all. The problem is they sort of like, no, let's rewrite the book until what it really means. The book's already there, you know.
Right.
All these literary theories and stuff, it's really high quality bullshit. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear here.
Oh, that's interesting, because I
high
also
quality nonsense. It's,
was
it's
an academia.
Really, really stupid stuff. Like,
yeah.
It is really, like, so for example, they have the Marxist literary theory. So you have like a beautiful poem about how nice the oats are in the fields and the trees, and I'm enjoying the sunshine and I feel happy and so on. And then the literary theory is about, you know, the supply crisis of oats in the 1830s when this was written. And, you know, right. Really it's a social commentary, because that's what it's always about.
Right.
Always about class. And then you have the feminist, which is always about the relationship between the men and women, and nothing else, and content matters, and much, much weirder ideas than that. Freudian, you know, it's all really about banging your mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's part of the reason why I sort of turned sour on that. And at some point, I realized that through no conscious decision of my own, that I had become a professional chess writer.
Hmm.
And then I decided, okay, I want to do this professionally, I should do it right. And that's the beginning of quality chess.
Okay. And what I think is so fascinating is that while you're pumping all of your energy into writing these books, you're still finding time to try to get better at chess, to reach IM, and then to reach GM, you know, many years after that. What is causing you to think like, I need to still put all my energy into this? Is it just that much fun? Did you just feel some drive that I need to get these titles? What was driving you there?
I think actually the work with the books very much created work habit for me that led to me becoming a grandmaster. Becoming IM was very much trial and error. Becoming a GM was sort of growing up and being an adult to some extent. And in the Danish education system, it's not normal to go straight from like high school to university. It's usual that people, they do something else for a while and then they come in. And the kids were like 18, 19 at university, usually struggle, especially in humanities. So it was sort of the average age, maybe right, 21, 22. So I had been in there and hadn't really worked out for me. I tried again and didn't really work out. But this time, further. Technically, I'm still a student of Copenhagen University. But,
nice.
I can still finish it in theory. But the guy who is, I was doing my thesis with, he just retired.
So
that was a bit unfortunate. But I think that ship has sailed. I'm more thinking about retiring than graduating.
Do you still have your student ID? Like, can you get student discounts at the movies?
No. But my partner has hers, so I can use that.
Oh, okay, that works. Okay, well, this is a pretty fascinating story. Just your own improvement. You sound like an adult improver, right? You have like this full life as an author. I imagine as a trainer as well. You're still grinding, trying to reach the next level. You do reach it, and it sounds like the secret is you just write lots of chess books. So that's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to quit my job, just write. Mine will be very low quality chess books, and I assume it'll get me to grandmaster.
Well, you know, my books are famous for being unread, you know. So, as I said, I don't think that is the path I would recommend. I would say with regards to being trainer, yeah, I was helping some other kids and there was something. But it really was in 2005 when I met the mother of Sabino Brunello that part of my life started to really happen. At that point, I already had the GM norms, and I knew at some point I would become a GM. It just took longer than I expected. But anyway, I met her, and she said, my son really needs help. He's 16, he's very talented. And I said, okay, sure. And I worked with him for some years, and I think he peaked at like 26, 20 or 30. And then he decided to take it more easy, and he's Italian, you know, he likes the cafe and so on. And we simply stopped working together because he got fed up with working. It was really, really working for him, you know?
Yeah.
And just around in that process, 2009, I met Boris Gelfand. But this time here, we spoke more, and then we played in this rapid event. He won with 7.5 out of 8 or 8.5 out of 9, something like that. And I made like 50%. But when I offered him a draw in a winning position when I was running out of time, he was like, yeah, of course. You know, so there was that little thing. And then after the tournament, you know, I sent him some training material because we've been talking about some things, some exercises. And he wrote back, "Oh, I failed to solve the first 10 exercises. I think I need to take this seriously."
Uh-oh.
So he took it seriously. And then a few weeks later, he went to the World Cup and won.
Wow.
And then he was like, "Well, this is good for me. Do you have anything else?" So I collected more and more material, and he kept winning. He, you know, won the candidates, and then he almost won the world championship.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, that's the that became six books. The first book is a Quality Chess Puzzle Book, which mm-hmm. technically has John Shore as the author. It's published more or less the same time as the Attacker Manual 1. We didn't want to have my name on both. And also John, he finished the writing of the Puzzle Book. So with that, and then the five exercise books of Grandmaster Preparation, they were all the material that I gave to Boris in this period.
And Boris was quite a bit older, right? For someone who's reaching a world championship level.
Well, he was slightly younger than Anand, like in months or something.
Oh, okay. I didn't even realize that.
But or maybe he's slightly older by a few months, but they're very close in age.
Okay.
But the age, combined age, was the highest since Lasker against Taras or something like that in 1908, or like so it was something like that. Maybe there was a Yanovsky match or something like that. And Anand was the first world champion over 40 since Petrosian, who resigned on his 40th birthday against Spassky in 1969. Yeah. And otherwise, you have to go back to Lasker.
Yeah. Yeah, just when I think of Gelfand, for some reason, I was thinking he was like 40s, picking up your material and making this gigantic improvement.
Which... Well, no, he was very strong then. Of course, like, for sure, it helped a lot.
Okay.
But he was shared second in the Mexico World Championship in 2007.
Okay.
But no, the training worked.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And on the back of that, Sam reached out if we could do some training. And we had some conversation online, came, visited. We got along well. And now it's 10 years working together.
Yeah, and Sam was a little bit older as well, right?
Well, he graduated from some university.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite Ivy League, but I think same area.
Gotcha.
22, I think. So he's born in 91, so he will be 32 later this year. He was about to turn 22.
Yeah. Do you work with many of like the 6 and 7 year old prodigies who you can shape to be, you know, the next Magnuses and be like 2900 or something?
Well, we do in the academy. So in Killer Chess training, we have young players of great talent, and we have older players of no talent, and they're all equally welcome and equally respected. A lot of the older players with no talents are the coaches, right? So,
oh, I thought you were talking about me.
Well, I don't you know, the talent of enjoyment is actually the most important one. This performance view on life, I'm not sure how healthy that is. I like to do things well, but I'm sort of happy enough with doing the best I can.
Okay, and I like that.
And if you cannot lose a good game, then I think sport's not good for you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I do work with young players in that way. But I actually found out as on a personal level, I put a limit on who I coach personally, and the limit is 2600.
Okay, gotcha.
Above, not below.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
So then... I have three students, private students like that at the moment, and then I have one person I visit like once a year for private camp, because we always have good time and hang out, and it's very pleasurable. Mm-hmm. And then I have a girl I was coaching before this who comes for, like, I played three tournaments, could look at my game, sure, you know, but but I don't take on new private students. I'm just too busy. And I thought the biggest impact is actually to get people from 26 to 27 plus.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's transition more to adult improvers out there. I did see you on Twitter, and this is one of the reasons why I finally did reach out to you after a long time of thinking, like, ooh, I wonder if he would come on the show. You started using the hashtag chesspunks hashtag on Twitter. What is it about that community that makes you think you want to engage with that community? What are your thoughts about these adult improvers trying to get better?
Well, I think it's just people who are serious about their hobby without in any way deluding themselves to whether or not it's a hobby. You know, I do occasionally get the email of, I am 21 years old, I am 1900, I want to dedicate my life to chess and become the next world champion.
Oh, wow.
And something along the lines of, it's a great honor for you to be allowed to coach me to come on this journey. Wow. And over the years, like, no matter like what people have thrown at me in various situations and so on, sometimes also people just sending pure abuse on Twitter or something, I found that the reply "no, thank you" is appropriate.
Oh, okay.
Like, people can be like, you are useless, you're a piece of whatever, and so on, and you have no talent, and so on and so on. Absolutely, this is absolutely true, probably. I think I have developed over many years an ability to communicate, although I'm not very good at communicating myself briefly. But otherwise, like, yeah, thank you for the invitation to insult each other, but no thank you. You know, I think it's sort of, that's fine. But I play chess. I'm in chess because I like chess.
Mm.
And I don't like barriers between people. And the idea, like, you were saying, you finally decide to reach out. I'm like, well, why didn't you just ask me? This could be our fourth time, you know, because I'm a little bit long-winded, so we maybe need more than one visit, you know?
Yeah.
Anyone invited me, I've always shown up for a conversation. People ask me questions in emails on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. I generally reply. Sometimes I go in and people just making general questions. There was one today. Today is the 18th of July. There was someone saying, can you explain releasing the tension? Mm. My coach was saying, and so on. I thought, okay, this is like, I just had a 1.5 hour lecture on this last week at the academy. So I thought, okay, let's show an example, explain it. And so why not? You know, it's, I generally try to involve myself in a way that is not creating any barriers. I certainly don't consider myself more valuable as a human being than anyone else, also not less. So that's why, you know, also I started playing again more, caring a little bit, because I'm now old. And I can play in the old people's tournaments. And the old people tournaments are extremely limited with the chance of meeting an Indian junior.
Yeah, that's
true. This is sort of like my recommendation. If you're 45 and you want to really improve at chess, it's like work for the next 5 years and then start playing. You know, I'm of course kidding. Of course you should play. Your rating will always adjust after 72 games. Your rating is the performance of your last 72 games. But like, when you lose to all these juniors, just don't pay attention to it. It's just kids on their way past you.
I'm encountering the same thing where it's like, I am going to turn 50 this year. I can technically play in senior events. It just feels weird to me because I don't feel like I'm a senior. And I feel like I'm going to walk into these events and have people be like, what? You're the kid. What are you doing here? So
I don't know. I play sports with people in their 30s and 20s. And even though I'm a little bit chunky, I managed to run at a similar speed and so on as them. So I don't feel old, but I think also age has been redefined because I think our generations are much healthier than the generations before. Yeah. And partially because our working conditions are much, much more pleasant. You think of people, 61 from 20, 30 years ago, they were not action heroes.
Yeah.
And I just went to see Mission Impossible 7 and like Tom Cruise doesn't look markedly different from the Top Gun. I mean, the first one.
Yeah.
So I think times are changing in that way and we're healthier and we'll probably decay also, but hopefully a bit later.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you want to hear what my core things about adult improvement here? Just to
what was focused. That?
Do you want to hear my core things about improvement?
Oh, yes, definitely.
I think that's sort of like, that's the thing that we're promised. And after all the not very interesting stuff about me, people who are scrolling forward looking for it will find the tack. Yep. Okay, so there are some things we know about improvement through centuries and centuries. So first of all, everything happens in the brain. There are things that are called muscle memory. That's also in the brain. Everything is in the brain. Our brain is can be operated in different ways, and we can have different biases and so on. But it is generally very, very elastic until the age of 12, 13. And there you can absorb anything very easily. Then it becomes increasingly less elastic until mid to late 20s. It used to be said that then the brain more or less couldn't change anymore. And the people saying it knew it was nonsense. I was listening to a podcast earlier today, and I cannot give you citations or anything, but this was serious guys who were saying that, these people were teaching us that the brain cannot change. Even they didn't believe it. But they were sort of sitting on their own their own research and scholarships and professorships and reputation based on the fact that it couldn't change. But we all know that the older you get, the slower you learn. But on the other hand, we're much smarter and we can be much more effective. And we cannot, in any way, as we get older, we cannot compete with young people who are taught well and focused and pushed and guided. It can't be done. Just as we can't outrun them if they're training well, we can't outplay them if they're training well, outlearn them. It just can't be done. But that does not mean that we cannot make big improvements compared to ourselves, which I think is what adult improvement is about. Mm-hmm. It's not about finally, entering into the top 10 and becoming a professional. It is about really enjoying the journey of improving yourself while maybe not enjoying the journey of making money as much, which is the case for a lot of people. And it's good to know the basics. So let's be very, very basic. The first thing is we know that to develop good habits, we need to have mass repetition. Repetition is known as the basis of learning. Now, in order to develop good habits, you need to repeat at a speed where you can control the habit. Mm. So if we take in from other fields, like let's say music, which is a pastime of mine, if I need to learn a musical technique, I will learn it slowly so I learn it correctly. And then I will increase speed very slowly because I want to stay in control all the time. I want to be sure that I'm doing the right thing. The same if you are driving a car, you don't start going 55. Most people don't have that desire, and the people who have that desire, you know, they will crash eventually. But we start with learning basics and then controlling them. And when we control them, we can then build on them. And there are many skills in chess. And it's not just about knowledge. There's also a lot of skills. And usually to play better, you have to make better decisions, which come from better thinking and from experience in decision making.
When you say go slower, real quick, just to follow up.
Yes.
How does that translate in chess? Like, I understand with music and with driving, you literally are going slower. What do you mean by go slower when you're...
Okay, let's imagine you're solving an imaginary puzzle as you're training. Now, the advantage of music is I can play the same piece of music again and again and again and again and get training experience out of it. While with chess positions, even though there's a whole woodpecker discussion, you know, like... it really very quickly you run out of value in training the same, thinking the same about a position. You need new positions. So in that way, chess is mentally more difficult than other things. But there are still some basic things. So for example, let's say that you are my I was your coach and you're my pupil, and we were going to teach calculation, which is
that statement you made is a binding contract. Okay, go ahead.
Binding contract. We will both imagine this, but never live on it.
What?
That is absolutely agreed. You can always join our academy. The website doesn't vet anyone, although if you come in and behave very, very appallingly, we might have to promote you to coach. Okay, just kidding aside. So back to the topic. Let's say you want to improve your calculation. And I look at your calculation. And now this is, of course, an imaginary situation. I know it's nothing like this. But your calculation is not really great. Imaginary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would say, okay. So what are you doing? And, you know, like, I'm thinking moves in my head. And I'm like, okay, fine. We're at scratch. Let's start there. Okay, so first of all, the thinking process has three steps. You look for the options, you analyze your options, and you choose the best one. And it's amazing how grandmasters can be bad at this. And then you say, okay, let's start with looking for the options. And you're sort of looking at the position, you look at one, you see some option, and then you start tolling this thing off. And I'm like, no, let's go back. Yeah, you need to learn to see all the options. And the options are moves that you could imagine yourself playing. It doesn't mean that, you know, when you look deeper, they're good or bad. It's just moves you could imagine yourself saying. By the way, when I say options or ideas, other people say candidates. So.
Yeah.
I say options because that's English and it's not translated from early 20th century Russian. Options is much better, or ideas, which is different from moves, because an option or idea, for me, like a little guideline could be, it's a three-move sequence, my move, your move, my move, where there's some sort of direction. It's not just, oh, I could go there, I could go there, I could go there. No, I could go there with some intention. Okay. So first of all, we look at that and we notice, okay, you're actually pretty crap at looking for ideas.
I am.
Imaginary. Totally imaginary, right? So I would say, okay, you need to solve a lot of really easy tactics. Now, in the past, I would give you a book. In the future, I might give you a book. And if people are wanting books, my recommendation at the moment is for this particular thing is Step Method 5 and 6. They're very cheap books. They don't come with solutions, as I remember. I sold mine to someone who I recommended should be studying them. He was like 1800.
Okay.
So have them, and when you are training, make sure you are actually training looking for the options. Now, you could technique this in different ways. You could train yourself as simply looking at the board and see what you can find and then write down options, something like that. Sometimes taking notes in training is a good thing. Don't do it to a tournament or Tony Rich, he will default you. Another option is could be like, okay, I want to look at this Ramesh's idea of all the moves in the A, B, C, files like that, or my own, which is look at all moves with all the pieces. So you simply actually look, if I go there, is anything happening? No. If I go there, is anything happening? If I go there.
Gotcha.
So you go in and you sort of are a little bit stilted. It's not natural. It's not how you would play during a tournament. But you are trying to train this specific thing. Mm. You're actually trying to enhance one of your chess skills, and looking for options is potentially the most important skill. Now, if you're doing something like that for the first time, you're going to get tired very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you're controlling your brain rather than the brain controlling you. Now, what you want to do is over time, you want to develop new instincts, new defaults. So there's a lot of things that you will do get automatically for free, or that you can do easily, which at this point will exhaust you. An example could be like we have these three questions, which are great for looking at positions where there's not much for calculating. You can use them for anything, but specifically these positions, when people don't know what to think about, these three questions are a great way of coming up with ideas. There's no real wrong or right answers, but I have had them 50,000 times. Given or receiving or done myself. I cannot look at a position without looking for the worst place piece and identifying very, very quickly.
Mm.
It's very difficult for me. Color schemes, like, you know, most of the pieces have a clear preference of color. Pawns, knights, and bishops, they can only control one color square at a time. The queen obviously has a stronger dominance on one color than the other. Only the last three chessmen, the king and the two rooks, don't have this kind of preference. So that's why the game is so color-oriented, because most 13 out of the 16 chessmen we start with, all have this color preference. Not necessarily the same color, but still. And then structure, we put the pawns so they all defend each other very frequently,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes opposite. So we sort of divide the center between us. And there's a lot of color things like that. And I cannot unsee them. But when I became maybe GM, I didn't really see them in the same way. And that kind of work, you want to get a lot of things for free. But the starting point is to be able to do it. So, for example, if somebody wants to improve their rating from 1800 tremendously, I would not recommend going to Chessable and buying a Polish opening file and sit and memorize it endlessly, mm-hmm. which seems to be a lot of what adult improvers are doing now. Now, I don't have anything against Chessable at all. It's a decent platform, and there's some good content and there's some bad content. They're also a business. And I can promise you, as Quality Chess, we have published books that... if we had seen them in their final form, we probably wouldn't have agreed to publish them. But we are also a business, because to publish the good stuff, sometimes you have to put out what you wish didn't exist like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not telling on anyone. It's getting much, much, much less. I'm going to throw one guy under the bus. There's a book called... Chess for Kids and Parents, which was so bad that when we put it out, the third owner was the one who really wanted to do it. John and I, we edited it together. And in the end, rather than writing us as editors, we wrote the third guy. His name's Ari Siegler. We wrote him as editor, like he wanted us to publish this book. He can be the editor. We put that on page two. But the same with Chessable. There's a lot of really bad openings, courses on bad openings. And if you want to play like that, you can play like that and look at it. But memorizing it endlessly, that's not the path to improvement. There is also on Chessable a lot of good tactics you can do. And generally, the tactics done by vetted by human and books, and we talked about the woodpecker. That's the best-selling tactics course in Chessable. We published it. That is a really good source for improving your chess,
mm-hmm.
and training the decision-making process. And that is, if I had to say, like, I can only give you one thing to go from 1800 to 1900 or something like that, I'd go learn to see the options.
Okay.
Do simple tactics and have this training of simply looking at all the pieces. Where can it go? Write them down, then analyze and so on, and allow the process to be slow because you want to be in control of it. Because yeah. You will always speed it up. You will always expect things to go faster than they should. You always expect results faster than they come. And this is there's a bigger explanation behind that. But essentially, it's because we compress time, and therefore we also imagine things happening is compressed. Let's imagine your latest flight. 95% of it was sitting in a seat looking at the guy snoring in front of you. But mm-hmm. somehow you remember that as a little bit, but elbowing him on the way out, which felt so satisfactory, you know, that's sort of like 60% of it, right? You know, there's events, and then there's this big blob of non-event time, which we... Our brains are not really designed to remember it or to plan with it or something, because there's no events.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's why things take longer than you thought they would. But do that as a process.
Okay.
And yeah.
Okay. So slowing down means sort of taking each of the bits and really exploring them carefully. So the example you gave was candidate moves, ideas, really going through and getting that down instead of just going like, sure. I looked at two moves, but really emphasizing that. And then we can do that in other areas as well.
Yes. So when I say slowing down, I would say the most important thing is being really conscious of your process. We have a way, a lot of our actions in daily life are automated or intuitive. Mm. You want to be conscious about your choices. You want to be steering the process so that you can develop a process of how you want it to be. We have this great plasticity as humans. We can change the way we think. I actually taught myself to think slower, which was mainly an advantage. And you can change your whole personality if you want. We have the plasticity. We just have to like be very conscious about it. Some things about ourselves are more difficult to change, but as humans, we have greater adaptability. But if you want to improve your thinking, you have to have mass repetition of doing it right.
Mm.
Now, you have to decide what doing it right is. The great thing about anything that's physical is it's visual. But we have to do things in our head. And the biggest mistake we can think of is, because it's in our head, it's under the laws of magic and not under the laws of the universe. No, but you know it. Like yeah. You hear people say, pull yourself together.
Yeah.
Which means, by an act of will, change how your brain works.
Yeah.
That is the laws of magic right there. And that is not how it works. No. What you have to say, okay, there's a lot of automated processes, and whenever they are automated, I have to go in and stop them and take over. Mm-hmm. And I have to have conscious, concentrated effort. Concentration means the removal of everything that's unnecessary. It is rather than multitasking, which you can do when it's intuitive, everything is on automated programs. No, you want to actually be in control here, so you can only do this. Yeah. And it's tiring and it's hard. And anyone who thinks they will fail, yes, will fail, because there's another important key concept, important key idea that everyone who wants to improve at something needs to understand. They need to learn how they personally improve.
Okay.
They have to learn to work. The idea that you will sit down and now you will do training is how most people would think of it, but also mindlessly naive. Of course, you will have to learn down and sit. You have to learn to train. Like, I play the guitar. In my opinion, I'm absolutely ridiculously bad. I'm probably my level is like 1600-1700. I can never even reach the, I will never reach the 2300 level of someone playing for free in a bar, probably. Maybe I will when I retire and focus 8 hours a day. And so, who knows, yeah? But for everyone outside music, you know, like I'm like virtuoso, right? You know, I can do a lot of things. It seems like, wow, and it's so effortless and so on. But I'm just not at professional level, and I'm not even at the pretend professional level, right? And but you know, through that, I've learned very much about learning the need to learn. And by the way, if there's any coaches listening in, you need to have something you're learning that you can't do, and it shouldn't be chess, but it's something else. You need to be a student. You need to have that as a physical, emotional experience as a coach, and you will gain so many ideas and insights and so much empathy into your students. And I'm not just talking about empathy in the level of feeling and hoping they'll do well and so on, but in understanding their thought process, their emotional processes, and
the visceral feelings of failure.
Well, it's not necessarily failure, it could also be success, but just the feeling of learning, the struggle of learning. That was a lecture.
a big question that I have is, do you think it's possible for an adult to become a titled player? Let's say you have a 40-year-old who's like 1600 and really wants to become, you know, 2200 or something. Is that possible in your mind, or is that just impossible?
So from 1600 to 2200?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's a big jump. It requires a big effort. And not everyone would be able to do it. I think. But it's like you also don't want to necessarily sell all your possession and go follow me, yeah. I cannot promise eternal life or 2200.
Okay. So you're saying something like it's possible, but it would be...
Well, it's clear it's been done. You know, it's been done many times. Like John Shaw, who's the other owner of Quality Chess, when he was 19, he was 1600.
Oh, okay.
And he became a GM before I did.
Oh, wow. Okay. He went all the way to GM. Okay.
I think Jonathan Hawkins was quite a strong, maybe still is quite a strong GM. Like also main improvement was in adult life.
Okay.
And many other guys like me, you know, you can look it up, but I was possibly under 2200 at 20. And I was 25, 42, and I could have, if I didn't get the job and the kit and decided there was no real path, I could have made 2600. I couldn't have made 2650. I don't think so.
Mm, okay.
But like, okay, if I, on the other hand, if I was like six and had me as a coach now, and you know,
yeah,
then back in time and so on, yeah, I could become a top 10 player. In my understanding, top 10 goes down to around number 20, 25, because they're all up there at some point and then drop down, right?
Yeah.
So I could maybe have done that.
Okay.
You know, I don't have the talent of
okay. So it's not an impossible task.
You're in Nepomniachtchi or Carlson, you know.
Yeah. I think adults often hear that, like, wanting to become, say, master is just a ludicrous thought, even that they shouldn't even think about that. And you're saying it's possible. It's very hard, and you have to make a lot of sacrifices, but it's possible.
Well, it's time. It's time, and it's having really good work patterns. But a lot of people are... Now, let's say you... Because this is something I do at times when I get into sports. So at the moment, I'm playing soccer. And I'm kind of really enjoying it. I'm playing with all these kids, like, you know, 36 and 28 and something like kids, you know?
Yeah.
And I like the fact that I can sort of play even with them. Okay, I'm... Well, let's say my age hasn't made me worse at soccer. I'm as bad as always was. But some good things, some bad things. But I'm thinking at the moment, like, I wish I was faster. Mm. I wish I could run more. I wish I could run up for the attack and run back for the defense. Now, most of the time, I choose to stay back for the defense because nobody comes back. Nobody can run both ways.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, okay, I might need a break before I do it again, but like, I can run up and run back. I want to be able to do that for an hour and a half with breaks. And I'm thinking, okay, now there's the slow way of improving, which is putting on a pair of trainers, go out, run a bit, then stand and try to breathe, then run a bit, then breathe and so on. But I know that's not the most effective way. Most effective way is to go to the gym, put the treadmill on a 10-12% incline, and sprint uphill for as much as you can. Lie on the floor and just try to breathe and fail, more or less. Hope they don't call an ambulance, and then do it again. And it's bloody hard.
Yeah.
But I can promise you, I've done it before, and your speed is beyond the chart. Remember, somebody put a drop shot with me at tennis after I've been doing it for a few weeks.
Yeah.
Time, and he was still coming up when I was reached the net and smashed it. He was like, "What happened?
You know,
this is like this is the biggest compliment you can ever have."
Yeah.
What happened? In chess, of course, the biggest compliment. This happens to some of my students at times. Is like they get accused of computer cheating.
Yeah.
How did you do it? We know you're cheating. How did you do it? And they're like, "Well, I was working with a coach and so on and so on." No, nobody makes those kind of results without cheating.
Yeah.
And like that's a big compliment if you're not cheating, but sometimes can also be a little bit difficult to deal with. But yeah, it's you have to train well. And it's good to know what deliberate practice is. Now, this is, you know, the famous 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
So the misunderstanding of this concept is that sort of putting on your shoes and dithering around in the park for 10,000 hours will make you incredibly fast. No, it's his name is Anas. Because it was made famous by this New York intellectual writer, but it was another guy, Andersen, or maybe something like that. I think Swedish guy who sort of was explaining it. Deliberate practice is where you're very razor focused on improving on where you are weak.
Okay.
And it's a struggle. And if the more you push, the more you will improve. But, you know, if you're coming home after an 8 hours workday and you're already board with the kids for 2 hours in the morning and, you know, fight for them 3 hours in the evening. And then from 10 to 12, before your 5 hours of sleep, you have some time to improve at chess. It's going to be very hard to do really razor-focused practice. But you are much better off doing half an hour or 20 minutes of that a day where you're actually really there and nowhere else. You're trying to something really clear and concrete, trying to improve this. And then rather than mindlessly repeating the monkey's bum on Chessable or playing blitz games on Chess.com or Lead Chess, nothing against any of the three platforms at all, if used well, like most things. Members all three places, personally. But if you're doing that half-mindedly, don't call it training. It's not. Training is where you're actually really focused, pushing yourself to improve at something you find difficult. That is training.
Yeah, and that's the hard part.
And the thing is, it requires a lot of mental and physical energy. And it is also painful.
Yeah.
And this is why it's so difficult.
Yeah, for sure. We are very quickly running out of time. I asked my Patreon subscribers if they had any questions. And there's two questions. Feel free to handle them very quickly because we are about out of time here. But one person, Tim Milgram, says, how many OTB games do you think adults need to play regularly to see their hard work pay off? In other words, do we need to be playing a lot in addition to studying if we really want to see those results?
Yes. So I can't give you a number because everyone's different, but an important part of playing chess is making repeat decisions. You need to make decisions on every move. You need to handle time. You need to handle being there. And you need to have good decision-making process. Now, personally, I start playing a little bit again now. And I play really badly. And my problem is not understanding. It wasn't really calculation. It hasn't been the openings, which is surprising for me. But it's actually decision-making, which is... It's not because of indecision. It's a mental fatigue played in. Bad habits coming back because you never fully eradicate it. It's a longer discussion about neurology. But if you're not playing and seriously analyzing your games, with trying to find out what did I do wrong, why did I do it wrong, and how could I have come to a better answer? If you don't do these things, you're complicating your improvement. Now, there is never one way of doing anything, really. There's always many, many ways of doing the same thing. You can become much stronger focusing on openings only, much stronger focusing on endgames only. And as in the rest of life, you can do anything in a million ways. But I think it's a very powerful way of enhancing your training experience. Also, it will tell you what you need to work on. When I work on my my students' game, you know, it's like one student who's quite a good player. I can't tell you his name, I'm sorry, but household name, looked at his games, and we thought, okay, you lose concentration when you have winning positions. You really need to improve on that. We need to work on concentrating in general, and you need to do better. And next tournament, he didn't. I was like, I felt like, what is this magic here? A student who improves in the level, in the way that you want him to, and just does what you say. It's as a coach, it's like, I never came across anything like it. Yeah. Second question.
Okay. Next question is Rich Burgess asks, what is the value in studying older games, like, say, Capablanca, Tal, Petrosian? And do you think there's some specific order that the master should be studied in, or just study master games?
Very simple. When that kind of advice came out, or was very prominent, which was when I was young, like in my teens and 20s, at that point, far less games have been played than has been played since. I personally very rarely look back at games from previous century. I don't really use them in my training. We just had a camp on positional play, and 90% of the games for us from the Sharjah tournament played in May. I analyzed the whole tournament and thought, okay, this is sort of like the idea. Analyze the whole tournament and see these are relevant things. Right. And minimum rating was like 25, 20 or something to play, few wild cards. And Eric Icy won, I think. And Gorkes was there. And like these strong guys over 2,700, just under the elite. And I analyzed these 30, 40 games for every round. So that's like 360 games. Yeah, I'm a workaholic, but I analyzed all these games. And then, of course, some of them quick draws, not very interesting. But And that was the basis of it. The argument for using the games of Capablanca and Lasker and so on was that often the level of their play is much stronger than the other ones. That's one of the arguments. Another argument was that these guys were like incredibly strong and so on. You know, read The Great Predecessors. It's great. But I'm not sure how valid this advice is. For a long time, it was the only material which was really readily available. This advice predates database.
Yeah.
The games of the Argentinian Championship 1990, probably much more important for studying chess than the World Championship of 1948, if you analyze them.
Okay.
But we didn't have access to them. Yeah. We had the classics, and the advice is probably a lot to do about that. So I don't think it's necessary, but also they are good games. They are well annotated. Especially if you have them annotated from players themselves or high quality information. Generally, high quality information doesn't mean matter really what it's about. Okay. Kevin, thank you for the invitation. I know I have exploited your patience and your indulgence way beyond what I should have done. So I'm going to let you say goodbye, and we can always do a part two if I can find a way to sell something so I can bribe you.
Yes, that sounds great, because I have so many questions. I have a list of so many questions. I do want to say, as we head out, Killer Chess Training looks amazing. Do you have like a minimum rating you suggest for that program, or is it really anywhere?
Yeah, you need to be like 1,400.
Okay.
So we're between 1,400 and 2,750. That's okay. Sort of the range.
Big range. Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming on. This has been very enlightening. We could do another 7 shows. This is going to be the My Great Predecessors, only the podcast version. So get ready for the next 7 episodes. We'll be coming back soon with some more. So I hope for all
see you tomorrow.
Of you out there. Yeah, I hope all of you out there, this is the week where you make all your big ratings gains. And if it's not, that's okay. Come back next week and we'll have another guest for you. Thanks so much. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you, Kevin.